try to be considerate of those who are visiting with us and express our appreciation for your presence. We're always encouraged and delighted to have visitors in our midst. I'd like to talk to you this morning about a subject that I believe that Jesus spends a considerable amount of time discussing and talking about, as well as even beyond Jesus' personal ministry does the Scripture deal with this subject considerably. Matthew, the 12th chapter, verses 1 through 8, Jesus encounters criticism at the hands of the Pharisees, and as he does so, he takes advantage of that opportunity and that confrontation to teach a lesson. Beginning in verse 1, at that time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the beads, or the heads rather, of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." But he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions? How he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, not nor for those with him, but for the priests only? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not sacrifice,' you would have not condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." There are many places where Jesus is confronted in similar fashion, and probably will not even think of all of them, but just to rattle off a few of them, in Matthew, the 23rd chapter, he devotes a large portion of the chapter with seven different occasions where he says, "Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites." Matthew 12:15, when the people came to him and asked if they should pay the tax to Caesar, he took the coin, you remember. And that was the famous, "Render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and render to God what is God's." Again, a lesson on hypocrisy. Galatians 2:13, Peter and Barnabas were even carried away with their hypocrisy on that occasion. And, of course, in our recent Bible class, 1 Timothy, the 4th chapter, he talks about false teachers who were hypocrites and liars. You know, this is sounds like something we're talking about other people. Certainly none of us would be like that. None of us would do anything like hypocritical, insincere, disingenuous. We would not be that kind of people. But the fact of the matter is, this appears to be a very, very serious problem with mankind and a continual temptation as we face certain situations. Machiavelli noted that the mass of mankind are often touched more nearly by appearances than by reality. So several researchers have shown that humans evolved really to play the game of life in a Machiavellian way. I'm not a great, well-read individual, but I have heard of this man and his book and how it has changed many men and how they think about what they should do in planning their lives, how they should live. And so the best way to cultivate a reputation for fairness is to really be fair. That'd be the best way. I mean, if you wanted people to think of you as a fair person, probably I'll just be fair. But since it's much harder to be fair than to seem fair, humans more often choose appearance over reality. In other words, we would like in situations to recreate, if you will, the appearance that we make by some sort of reasoning or rationale. And so Ben Franklin says, "So convenient a thing is it to be a reasonable creature since it enables one to find or make a reason for everything one has a mind to do. In other words, I'm a very reasonable man. And if you watch me do something, I'll give you a reason for it. It may not stand the test, but we do that. And so Franklin's observation has been confirmed by recent studies in self-deception. In everyday reasoning, humans do little to get real evidence when taking positions or making decisions. And they do even less to get evidence for opposing positions. Instead, they tend to fabricate pseudo-evidence, often after the decision's already been made. In other words, we justify our actions instead of act justifiably. is really what we often do. And that's not a good thing. Hypocrisy is a phony persona designed to gain favor or position in some relationship. There's a purpose behind it. There's a reason why we do it. Its result is to be unfair to persons or situations that demand honesty to be maximized. And so that's what we're going to talk about today as we discuss this event that Jesus, in the life of personal ministry of our Lord, I want us to look at the situation, try to evaluate what Jesus is evaluating and teaching. And once we understand that, then I want us to talk a little bit about trying to understand hypocrisy and its temptation, and then try to make some application, if we can, to our lives. So anyway, what happens to prompt this lesson from the Lord? Well, what takes place, we just read it, is His disciples and He are walking along on a journey, and they pass through some grain fields. And His disciples pluck some grain as they're going through to feed themselves. They're hungry. And so they take some grain as they're walking through, pick it by hand, whatever shelling needs to be done they can do with their hands or whatever they have to do, and so they can eat the grain. And the Pharisees observe that, and their accusation is that you're doing something unlawful on the Sabbath. Now, if what they were doing was lawful or unlawful, Jesus could have quickly acknowledged that and pointed it out. He could have said, "We're sorry, we did something wrong. Please forgive us." Or He could have said, "No, what we did was right, and here's the reason why." But that's not what He did. He did not simply refer to Deuteronomy 23 24 and 25, the verses there, which He could have, as we said. He could have easily quoted Old Testament scripture that says, "When you enter your neighbor's vineyard, then you may eat grapes until you're fully satisfied, but you shall not put any in your basket." You don't harvest the neighbor's grapes. But as you're walking by and you're hungry, you're allowed to eat your neighbor's grapes. "When you enter your neighbor's standing grain, then you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not wield a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain." You don't harvest his field and take it home with you. But as you're walking through the field, if you're hungry, you are allowed. It is simply an accommodating thing. But Jesus didn't do this. He didn't point this out and just end the discussion by saying, "You're just wrong. What we did was lawful." Because Jesus knew that they already knew the law. He understood that they were trying to find fault with Him and His disciples. And He understood the hypocrisy of how they were doing it. So He reminds them of David's occasion when he came to Ahimelech, the priest, when he was fleeing from Saul. One of the many of those occasions when David was running for his life because Saul was trying to kill him, and David was so honorable that in all the opportunities he had to kill Saul, he would not do it. But at any rate, he comes to the priest and he says, "Me and my men need some food. What have you got?" And he says, "Well, we don't have anything except the bread of presence. That's all we have available." And so David takes that bread and eats that bread. Now Jesus, in this text, and I don't want our conversation to turn to the the annual debate or the ongoing debate of to whether David, what David did was sinful or not. But Jesus says, they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests only. So I'm going to take Jesus' word for it, that what David did was unlawful. And Jesus uses that in his discussion with them. Why did you not call to your memory what David did when you criticized my disciples for going through these fields? He then references another situation that's possibly even more confusing until we try to understand where Jesus is going with his discussion. And that is number 28, 9 and 10, where it talks about the priests making offerings that were commanded offerings on the Sabbath. So Jesus, and Jesus refers to that as profaning the Sabbath. Well, it doesn't appear that they profaned the Sabbath if they obeyed the commands of the Sabbath, does it? And so we have to conclude that the priests were not profaning the Sabbath, but Jesus was making a reference to the fact that they did something on the Sabbath. And that seems to be what the Pharisees were hammering about and complaining about, was somebody actually did something on the Sabbath. And they, as a result, accused his disciples of actually harvesting when they weren't harvesting at all on the Sabbath. And so, why does he do this? He does it because Jesus' purpose is to turn this confrontation into a pointed discussion about their hypocritical views concerning the law and his ministry and his disciples, all of those things. They have views that are biased and prejudiced and hypocritical. And he's going to point that out to them on this occasion. And so, let us see what the lesson is. What his disciples did, as we already noted, was lawful. It was perfectly appropriate for them to do that. Yet the Pharisees said they broke the Sabbath. Now, why would they say that? Well, of course, the Pharisees didn't really keep the law concerning the Sabbath. The Pharisees kept what the traditions of the fathers said concerning the Sabbath. And so we now refer to the compilation of those traditions of the fathers as the Talmud. That's the book that Judaism uses today, but it's rabbinic law, essentially. It's the fathers, the rabbis, have determined this is the way we should do this. And it differs from the law of Moses. They have taken the law of Moses and they have altered it to fit what they choose. That's the very confrontation of Matthew 15, 9, 1 through 9, where they were not taking care of their parents who were in need, and they were using an excuse of that to say, we'd already given that money in the treasury. And Jesus said, in vain do you worship me, teaching for doctrines and commandments of men. And so hypocrisy on that occasion, the hypocrisy that they practiced in Matthew 15 was sinful because it was vain worship. And the hypocrisy they practice here is the same thing. And so we must recognize that this hypocrisy thing is a pretty serious deal. It's not something that we need to walk lightly around or to just take lightly and ignore. Alfred Edersheim is kind of the acknowledged Judaism expert. And his statement reads like this: the disciples' conduct was not a violation of biblical law, but rather a transgression of rabbinic law, which I've put in parentheses there, is really just what we've often heard referred to as the traditions of the fathers. In other words, it was a violation of what they had altered and changed the law of Moses to actually mean by their influence and by their practice. And so, Jesus concludes they are hypocrites because they find His disciples doing something within the law, but contrary to the traditions of the fathers. The same thing as Matthew 15:9. See? It's the same thing all over again. They're using what we say the law is to critique the conduct of others. I believe that's a lesson in and of itself. I don't know if you've ever heard people use this phrase or not, but I'll throw it out there and then let's see if we can dispose of it after that. You ever heard somebody use the expression Church of Christ doctrine? Well, Church of Christ practices and teaches a doctrine, but it's not the Church of Christ doctrine. It's the doctrine of Christ. And when we begin to refer to our teaching and our practice as ours, it may be because it has become ours, and we have tampered with it here and there and yon to tailor it to what we want, just like the Pharisees did. Dangerous. It's a dangerous temptation. We need to be careful not to have that happen. But what Jesus contrasts this with, and where He points out the hypocrisy, is that they perfectly accepted everything David did. David's fine. And Jesus described David as actually doing something unlawful. And so there's this thing that He's pointing out there. They don't criticize the priest for doing work on the Sabbath because it was a part of the law, and they hadn't altered that part of the law, I guess. But nevertheless, all of these things Jesus points out in this, and the disciples and the priests practiced lawful conduct. David did not. But the disciples' conduct was contrary to the traditions of the elders, and therefore they were being criticized and being challenged on that behalf. So, Jesus gives two explanations about His teaching on the Sabbath. First, He quotes Hosea 6:6. Now, Hosea 6:6 talks about, I desire compassion, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And He desires their service to be as a result of the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Now, when Hosea says that in Hosea 6:6, he is not teaching Israel to cease the practice of sacrifices. That's not what he's saying at all. And yet, Jesus quotes that here and says, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. If you had understood that, you would not have criticized or condemned the innocent. Hosea is challenging and dealing with an issue that Israel had developed, and that was that I will live the way I want to live because I can always offer a sacrifice and wash it away. That's what their practice had become. And so finally Hosea was saying, and God was saying through Hosea, I'm sick and tired of your sacrifices. They don't mean anything. They don't come from your heart. They're not anything you mean at all. Does this sound anything like someone who sins all week long and then comes and prays for forgiveness on Sunday or whatever? That's exactly the mentality that he's challenging here when he says, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. We still do the sacrifice. Jesus desires compassion, not sacrifice, but he still calls upon us to make sacrifices to serve. He still calls upon us to do those things that he's commanded us to do in service to him, which do require, to a certain extent, discipline and sacrifice. But the point is, he wants our sacrifice to be a sacrifice from our hearts, something that we do because we want to do that. We're serving, not because we're covering our bad actions, not because we're trying to correct problems that we create all week long. And so the point is that Jesus is not suggesting, and we're going to get to that point, he's not suggesting that every time something comes up, you should negate the law of God and go ahead and do what you think is best for humanity. Some people like to teach that point. But that's not what he's saying. Now, the second point he makes in verse 8 is this, and this is the powerful point of Jesus' whole teaching here. This is a central and pivotal point of everything. He says, "The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." I am the one who created the Sabbath, Jesus is saying. What is the lesson to them? I'm the Lord. Recognize me and serve me. Confess me. Obey me. Become my disciples. Because I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. I'm the one who created the Sabbath. I was there with God in heaven when the Sabbath was initiated. So Jesus always comes back to the lesson. Whatever he's correcting in mankind, whatever he's teaching mankind, he comes back to the verification of the validity of his message is that I am deity. I am God. I am the Son of God. And so, a third point that Jesus, the Lord of the Sabbath, makes is that he consistently taught them that there were things that were acceptable, if you will, exceptions to the Sabbath. If we go to Luke, the 13th chapter, and over there, there's a couple of passages I want to refer to in Luke 13 and one in Luke 14. In Luke 13, 10 through 17, Jesus heals someone on the Sabbath. This was a constant issue. And it makes one wonder if Jesus and God did not deliberately allow this to occur this way for purposes of teaching the lesson. But nevertheless, in verse 14, the synagogue official, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, began saying to the crowd in response, "There are 6 days in which work should be done. So come during them and get healed, and not on the Sabbath day." But the Lord answered him and said, "You hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox, his donkey, from the stall and lead him away to water?" Another situation over in the 14th chapter. He healed another person on the Sabbath. He says there in verse 5, when they were questioning it being lawful to heal on the Sabbath, he said to them, "Which one of you will have a son or an ox fall into a well and will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day?" There are things that must be done. Must be done in order of propriety and appropriateness. But that's not a defiling or a profaning of the Sabbath, Jesus said. And so he constantly seemed to be healing people on the Sabbath, which served to bring this up again, allow him to teach us this lesson over and over again. And so it is important for us to recognize that Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. I am not Lord of the Sabbath. And we translate that into New Testament teaching. I have no authority over the laws of God. The only thing I'm authorized to do is teach them. And so I want us to be sure that we don't learn from this, as some people have, that since it's inconvenient for this, that, or the other to take place, I do those other things on the Sabbath because they're more convenient, appropriate. He did not undo the law of Moses to draw attention to his deity, but he came not to undo the law of Moses, but to fulfill it. Remember Matthew 5:17. Where he says that, "I came not to destroy the law or abolish the law, but I came to fulfill it." That's what Jesus is coming to do. And so we need to recognize that there's this new thing on the horizon. That's what Jesus and John the Baptist spent their time doing, is preparing people for this new covenant that would come following the fulfillment of the old law. And the Pharisees were continually bombarding them by trying to hang on to the old law and deal with it rather than accepting the change and the transition that Jesus was offering. I want us to recognize something else about hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is a form of injustice or partiality. One of the things about the old law that was really, really a stickler was that God would not tolerate injustice. He would not tolerate people being treated without fairness. If you recall, when he specified the law, he not only specified that you're not to favor the wealthy person in your judgments, you're not to favor the poor in your judgments, he said as well. Out of the same law, he said, nobody gets favoritism. Everybody gets equal justice, equal treatment. And so he says in verse 17 of Deuteronomy, "For the Lord your God is the God of gods, and the Lord of lords, the great and the mighty and the awesome God, who does not show partiality nor take a bribe. He executes judgment for the orphan, the widow, and shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing." Goes on to talk about how God is fair to everyone. And so God is, he's the origin of justice or righteousness. And when we show partiality, we deny that occurrence. We deny justice by showing that partiality. And so in 2 Chronicles 19:7, the same term is used here. "Now then let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Be very careful what you do. For the Lord our God will have no part in unrighteousness or partiality or the taking of a bribe." Now, often that term taking of a bribe is injected into this discussion because very often that's what prompts impartiality, is someone coming along and making an offer to you, the judge, to sway you one way or another. "I'll make it worth your time to rule in my favor." So that's the kind of thing that is involved in hypocrisy. Now, I understand that most of us are not involved to that extent, but there's a point at which we begin, if we're not careful, we have the same temptation everybody else does, to respect one's personage over another. God doesn't do that. He doesn't do that. He offers salvation to everyone. Acts 10:34, in the case of Cornelius, Peter made the point on that occasion that the gospel was not selective. It was for everyone. God didn't show partiality. Romans 2:11, the same thing. And both of these were occasions when the writer, Peter's action recorded by Luke and Paul writing in Romans, was telling us that the issue currently was whether the Greek, the Gentile, could have salvation. Both these passages indicate, yes, they can. They're totally capable. God doesn't even show favoritism in whom He's going to have reveal His mind. The Apostle Paul, what's he described as one born out of due season? Isn't that the term that Paul uses about himself? He was one born out of due season. He said, "I'm less than all the other apostles," and all these things. But he's quick to remind us in the second chapter of Galatians that he did not receive what he has from these other apostles. "I didn't go see them and get the authority and the permission and the information to pass on to you. I received the revelation from God. God revealed this unto me." And so God didn't show favoritism, see, among whom he had a select group that he chose to reveal his word. And it didn't matter that the Apostle Paul came much later than the others. He treats all his disciples impartially, regardless of status. Ephesians 6:9, he tells, in that sixth chapter, he tells both servants and masters to treat one. Servants who are Christians, you work for your masters as if you work for the Lord. Masters who are Christians, you treat your servants who are Christians as brethren. And so there's no elevation spiritually. You own the company, I'm your janitor. We're both in the same eyes, in the same level in the eyes of God. He doesn't respect you a bit more than He does me. And so it's important that we recognize that in life, practically. In 1 Timothy 5:21, he talks about the treatment of all as they're being rebuked. A lot of rebuke talking about in in 1 Timothy 5, and he talks about, now he gives some special precautions to be taken in rebuking an elder. And those are for some very obvious reasons. You rebuke an elder without a couple of witnesses, you could be on the losing end of the rebuke, obviously, because the elder may have enough power and sway to wash away your rebuke when he actually deserves to be rebuked. So do it right. Go through the process appropriately so that when that elder's rebuked, he's rebuked appropriately and the good is done. The purpose of the rebuke is valid. Matthew 7, 1 through 5 is the obvious passage that talks about treating people fairly. We have the beam in our own eye, and we're busy trying to get the mote out of the other brother's eye. And so all of these instances are instances of fairness, justice, and righteousness. But when fairness, justice, and righteousness are betrayed, it is through hypocrisy that it occurs. He even demands in James 2, 8, and 9 that his children maintain these same standards when he talks about those who come into the worship. Some who come into the worship looking like $1 million, and some come in looking like they just got off the trash truck. Well, they're doing their best. What they wear, where they come from, doesn't make any difference, because every soul has an equal value. So that's the way God reasons with us and conducts His righteous behavior toward us. And naturally, we're His children, His disciples. We need to do the same. And so it's amazing the ability of man to misunderstand a well-illustrated story. Is Jesus saying David was right in violating the law? And if He is saying that, does that justify situation ethics? Well, now, I've heard brethren on both sides of the issue whether David violated the law. The only thing I can read to you is what Jesus said. He said he did something unlawful. That's all he said about it. He never commented on it further than that. Now, this is the conclusion of a man named Joseph Fletcher. You all heard more about him than I have in his book, Situation Ethics. Jesus blessed David's act on the basis of the situation. This means he, that is Jesus, concludes, only the end justifies the means and nothing else. So, in other words, whatever I want to come out, I can get it there any way I want. I can just do anything I want to bring about this goal, this end. And we know that is the most loose and disconnected kind of thought process man can have. But clearly, Jesus said, and this is a point I just made a while ago, in reference to David, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests only. That's what he said about David's conduct. And so, first of all, to say that Jesus blessed David's conduct is a stretch. You begin to pervert the passage and what it says. And secondly, to conclude situation ethics from that is ridiculous. So that's a little minor issue here as far as I'm concerned. I don't believe that most of us believe intellectually. I don't believe we take in our mind and say, I believe in situation ethics. I think the problem is we may practice it sometimes without even realizing it. We need to be very, very careful. So, Jesus didn't teach that we can alter God's law anytime it's inconvenient for us, and that we need, when he talks about getting an ox out of a ditch on the Sabbath, he's not saying, well, now if you have difficulty, it could be that you don't have a DVR and your favorite show's on TV when we're having services. You know, that'd be really inconvenient, wouldn't it, for you to have to miss that show and come to service. Well, that's an extreme illustration. But you see the point. Now, you'd bring that back gradually, and you see more and more opportunities. Jesus taught the Pharisees he was Lord of the Sabbath. That's what he taught. There was a change coming with him. Now, he says in John 1:17, for the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. And so, That doesn't mean there wasn't grace and truth in the old law. Doesn't mean there's not law under the grace and truth of the new covenant. What it means is that Jesus Christ will teach us about the grace and truth of all God's law. He'll teach us about justice and about righteousness. And we need to follow and listen to Him. So what are men hypocritical about today? Proverbs 23:23 says, "Buy the truth and sell it not." And the fact of the matter is that every one of us has something that if we're not careful, we become the hypocrite about. There are things that are very, very easy for me to stand up and just boldly shout from the rooftop. There may be other things that because of my relationship with different people and the influence people have on me, maybe I don't shout so loud about. Maybe I get kind of quiet about some things. That's hypocrisy. That's what we're talking about. And so when I know the truth, back to the Sunday morning worship service or whatever, and I'm missing for some reason, what reason is it? Is it reasonable? Or is it something I can say to the brethren, and I've kind of got them in a spot because they can't say I'm being unreasonable, so they just kind of allow me to go on and miss the service and give my excuse or my reason why? Are we back to Ben Franklin? Where he said, "Hey, I'm a reasonable man. I got a reason for everything I do. You know, I'll give it to you." Well, it may not be reasonable when it is laid alongside the Word of God and His expectation of His servant. And so when I fail as a Christian to do what God has asked me to do, and yet I offer a reason for that failure, I'm being the hypocrite. I'm hypocritical. I'm disingenuous. That's not the reason I didn't do it. The reason I didn't do it is because I wouldn't make the sacrifice necessary to come and serve the Lord when He asked me to. That's the reason I didn't do it. And I'm being hypocritical when I offer some excuse or some reason other than that. I should just state fresh that I just didn't want to do what God asked me to do. Now, attendance, that's always our go-to. Attendance is always our go-to. But it's not just attendance that we're responsible for. We're responsible for a lot of things. We're responsible to live lives that draw attention to our purity. We talked about in Bible class this morning. Our pure conduct. And so we're supposed to live those kind of lives. If I'm not living a kind of life, I'm disingenuous as I present myself to people as such a person. Hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is when I just lack the courage to do the right thing in the right situation. There's a couple of often confused things. Somebody shows immense courage. They're bold. They're standing strong in what they believe. And we call that character. That man's got character. Look at him stand up there and put himself out there. Well, don't confuse character with backbone. Some people just don't have a backbone, and therefore they face real temptations of hypocrisy. But other people have a great backbone, and they can be just as big a hypocrite because they can be wrong, but they can boldly shout what they believe, knowing good and well. Pharisees, what about the Pharisees? They weren't timid. They weren't lacking in a backbone. They were lacking in character. They would not evaluate the truth and accept the truth and make it a part of their lives. And so there's only one thing that eliminates hypocrisy in your life and in mine, and that is God. His Word, His person, what He has told us, what He's done for us. He is the way, the truth, and the life. Jesus says He is, John 14:6, no man cometh to the Father but by Me. This is the thing that will save us from hypocrisy. If we love the truth, if we love those words of faith and that sound doctrine Paul talked to Timothy about, then when the challenge comes, when the threat, the temptation, or whatever hits us, we'll rely on that. We'll call on that. And we'll be genuine. We'll deal with that problem in a genuine fashion. We will not be the hypocrites Jesus dealt with in His time and His personal ministry as He fought those, we might say, fanatical Pharisees as they were constantly trying to challenge Him and trying to do so with their hypocrisy. It is embarrassing enough. Don't know if you've ever done this before or not, but I was a young man, raised my hand in Bible class, and I told him what it was all about. The problem was it wasn't about that. And, you know, a couple hours later when I figured out what I'd done, you know, have you ever been sitting alone and have your face turned red because of something you said or did that you just now found out was wrong? Well, that's... We must be concerned about the truth, but we must be genuine enough that when we're wrong, we can admit it. We can admit it because the only way we can be right is to admit when we're wrong. Hypocrisy, we get accused. I don't want to go to church and sit among all those hypocrites. Well, the answer you've heard many times before, well, you'd rather go to hell and spend eternity with them. Because the hypocrites are not going to be in heaven, are they? But the only people trying to live faithful lives are found in places like this. Now all we have to do is, those of us who are trying, be sure that we continue to try and to be genuine enough to correct our own mistakes, admit our own mistakes and correct them, rather than to be pharisaical in our approach toward life. Maybe those here this morning who need to obey the gospel. We're so appreciative of you being here. We're so thankful that you think enough of the Lord to come here. Now we want you to think enough of the Lord to be sure that you are in harmony with Him. If your life is in disarray spiritually, if you've been separated from God by your sin in any way, whether you're a Christian having obeyed the gospel and fallen away, or whether you are someone who's never obeyed the gospel, our plea to you is, come as we stand and sing this song. Let us help you be in harmony with God.